Let me see if this is working now.
This
Let me
should
see
be
if this is
working
working
for
now. There we go. We should have multiple audio. Apologies for this, guys. We might have to trim off the start of this stream. But I think, yep, we can now hear you guys.
Okay. Everybody can hear me now?
There we go. I imagine people can hear you because I can see the desktop audio going up. Yep, there we go. Now we
okay,
can hear you. I'm sorry about that.
All right.
And when I come back, Evelyn, I'll show you exactly. I know exactly what you've done wrong there.
All right. I guess we start over from the beginning.
my apologies. It seems we've had some audio error from the desktop audio side. But we should now. I should now be able to get this working. What I will try and do then, I'll try and move around some of my windows because I've had to basically live reset up the stream on my end. So there may be some slight hiccups and some slight weirdness, re-kajiggering things on this end, but it should be okay. You should now be able to hear. But anyway, reintroduction. Hello, guys. Sorry about the tech issues at the beginning of the stream. We do have our guest today, Philosopher Cat, who is here. Say hello and intro yourself, Philosopher Cat, again, so now that people
hello.
Can actually hear you.
I've been unmuted. Thanks, guys, for having me on the stream. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you. I think it'll be very interesting. And as we were saying before we realized the tech problems, I do think this is a topic that merits more nuanced discussion than what the political climate typically permits it to have. For anybody who doesn't know me, I've got a YouTube channel. I sort of specialize in Julius Evola, been branching out into doing live streams on the Bhagavad Gita. There's a few other topics I cover. I'm a musician and astrologer, so I've got a sort of broad base of knowledge there. I wear many hats, but today I'm going to put on my Julius Evola hat, and we are going to talk about his essay, The Third Sex, I believe.
That is correct. And you were saying, although people may have heard you, Evelyn, you were saying that it was a much better summarization of the actual text, because the actual text is a bit less succinct.
No, it's more so just that he takes the vital bits out of Otto's work and puts them together in quite a nice way. I mean, we're not going to go through the entire essay, and the bit that we're actually going to go over is a bit we've gone over before, but it's just, I think we can... The angle we were coming at it prior to was for a slightly different discussion, and I think there is multiple contexts within which we can really look at these ideas. And it's not for the sake of, you know, turning the channel into some weird thing of always looking at this stuff, but I think when the opportunity comes up to look at it in a way that we normally wouldn't, I don't see why we shouldn't. And I'm going to sit here and just pretend and not die of embarrassment for that. Completely out of cock up at the start.
It's a very simple problem that I don't... It's I know exactly what's gone wrong there, but it's not your fault because OBS does that sometimes. Anyway, let us not dwell on the tech issue. Let's not focus on ooh, muted ooh. Yeah, shall we quickly get into some of the subject matter then?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean... Where do we really start? I don't know if we want to start with the little source I've got from Otto. I think I've got two actually from him. And it's just to briefly sort of go over his concept of what you know, as I sort of said by the failed intro, the ideals of male and female that we talk about and we try and think about in the abstract, and the actual sort of dimorphically sexuated individuals that exist in the real world.
Yes, I will very, very quick and dirty drag us a little desktop window here so we can see these sources. Sorry, guys, I'm like live switching right now. But
wait, tell you what, I can also send you the...
Now, I think one thing that people need to be aware of is that this concept of like intermediate sexualities actually long predates progressive politics. The third sex itself is it's a 19th century term for homosexuals, and later came to, you know, include, you know, a number of different LGBT types. I think it was Edward Carpenter that published a book called Sexual Inversion in of the very early 20th century, and he followed this kind of third sex model that had been established by the sexologists at that time. And he considered homosexual men as women trapped in men's bodies and vice versa. And so we're already seeing like this origin of like the more than two genders, this idea that there's an intermediate sex. But, you know, even before that, in Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes is talking about how this myth of the hermaphrodite, how modern-day humans are two halves of ancestral composite individuals who were essentially hermaphroditic, and they became insolent, and so Zeus punished them by splitting the masculine and the feminine halves apart. And so erotic love is basically each of these halves trying to recover its primordial state by finding and reuniting with their lost half. And it's this primordial state that Evola is kind of relying on as his foundation of erotic love in his book Eros and the Mysteries of Love. And both Weininger and Evola agree that there is like this ideal type of man and woman. You know, Weininger calls it ideal man and ideal woman, and Evola says absolute man and absolute Apologies woman. To. But we're basically talking about platonic forms here. I don't know. Is that the quote right there that you've got up on the screen? It may be, actually.
It is. Yeah. It is Otto Weininger, human beings, the state of the case as follows. There exists all sorts of intermediate conditions between male and female. Sexual transitional forms in physical inquiries as ideal gas is assumed.
Well, he's talking about the physics.
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, obviously,
I'm just laughing at the term. I'm just about ideal gas. It's funny. That is to say, a gas, the behavior of which follows the law of Boyle-Gay-Lussac. Exactly. Although, in fact, no such gas exists. I get what he's getting at here. To summarize what he's saying is there's ideal man, ideal woman, but everyone exists in a state between the two.
Yes.
Right. He says basically that male and female are like two different substances that are combined in different proportions, but neither one is ever wholly missing. Mm. And that ideal man and woman don't actually exist. Like, don't, you know, but the Platonic idea allows us to establish what the extreme ideal ends of the spectrum are, and then from there we can establish the intermediate conditions that we do actually find within humanity. And it's these ideal forms that are what help us obtain the knowledge about what is male and what is female. But, you know, both Weininger and Evola are saying, you know, within like real human beings, you never find the absolute. And within each of us, we have, you know, characteristics of the opposite sex to varying degrees. You know, we are, some of us are closer to that absolute than others, but none of us is really fully there. He says, I think in that same quote, that there's always this certain, he says there's always a certain persistence of the bisexual character and never a complete disappearance of the characteristics of the opposite sex. And he gives examples like how women grow colorless hair where men grow beards, and men have nipples and glandular tissue. So even like from a physical standpoint, we still see, you know, these kind of vestigial forms from the opposite sex.
Yes.
I think there was a slightly further down part that I think is interesting, because it gets across, I think, what he's trying to talk about, which is on a, you know, this idea that he's talking about, I think he refers to them later on as two different types of plasma that have the ability to sexuate you either towards male or towards female in varying degrees, and that people seem to have a sort of almost inborn limit to which they can reach, possibly in either direction, who really knows.
But yeah, he's got his weird equation here as well. I'm not sure what the plasma bit is.
That's in a later section of the text.
Oh, okay.
But it's the little bit that says, let it be noted.
Yes, clearly that I am discussing the existence. Yeah.
Yeah, let it be noted that clearly I'm discussing existence not merely of embryonic sexual neutrality, but of a permanent bisexual condition, nor am I taking into consideration that merely those intermediate sexual conditions, those bodily or psychical hermaphrodites upon which, up to the present, attention has been concentrated. In another respect, my conception is new. Until now, dealing with sexual intermediates, only hermaphrodites were considered, as if, To use a physical analogy, they were in between the two extremes a single group of intermediate forms, and not an intervening tract equally beset with stages in different degrees of transition. And I think this is one thing that's interesting that I sort of note, and this is by no means to have a dig at Yiz at all, but she obviously is sort of outwardly intersex. And because of that, there is a lot of people who, I mean, I don't mean to give her a pass in some sort of way that needs to be deserved or that or whatever else, but people seem to see that and the physical material manifestation of, you know, hermaphrodism or whatever you would want to call it as real. Whereas if you were to try and explain to them the fact that you could be very much the same in terms of mind and in terms of physiology, albeit except from some of the bits downstairs, that they don't, that doesn't then convince people. And I wonder if what it is really that derives that opinion in and of itself and that sort of perspective. Is it purely just a simple mind of, you know, they see the other sex as represented purely in the symbolism of like primary sex gonads, and that's kind of it. You know, there is no furtherance for secondary and tertiary sexual characteristics, which Otto seems to put actually is, you know, none of these are really the determining factors. The way that you truly understand the person is by kind of analyzing the soup of all of it.
I think we need to distinguish between sex and gender, because these terms are often used interchangeably. And a lot of times people say gender when they mean sex.
Yes.
Sex is biological. It's whether you're male or female, have an XX or an XY chromosome, whereas gender refers to masculine or feminine. Men, biological men can be feminine and biological women can be masculine, but that doesn't mean that they suddenly become the opposite sex. So this is why I kind of said we need a nuanced understanding of this subject. We have to have this nuanced understanding of opposites when talking about these subjects. So one example I like to use, it's an astrology example, but I think it explains it well. It's, you know, in astrology, gender is a big category. All five traditional planets have both a masculine and feminine gender expression. They each have like a certain sign they rule. That's their masculine sign and their feminine sign. And they're capable of moving through the fluidity of masculine and feminine and can express either. But the sun and the moon, the two luminaries, do not do this. The sun is always masculine and the moon is always feminine. Why is that? Well, it's because there's these two forms of opposites. So you have one sense in which opposites are fundamental categories of things that are absolutely not the same and show no spectrum of fluidity between them, you know, right versus wrong, black versus white. But then paradoxically, those same opposites exist and relate in a fluid spectrum that is inherent in their nature. Because they're a reflection of God himself, and both binaries and non-binaries exist inherently in nature. So while white and black may be fundamentally opposite to each other, they relate through a spectrum of grays.
Yeah.
And we need a sense in which categories are fundamentally dual in binary in order for there to also exist a simultaneous way in which they are not dual in binary. So this is why Evola and Weininger are both talking about these categories of like absolute man and absolute woman, even though they don't necessarily exist physically in that way. You know, we have the sun and the moon expressing the way in which the opposites do not meet, while all the other planets are able to express the ways in which they do meet. There are ways in which the masculine is definitely not the feminine and vice versa, but there's also ways in which those two principles can meet, relate, and unify.
Which
they do meet. And as individuals, none of us is exclusively masculine or feminine, but rather we contain a blend of those energies in different flavors and proportions. And our spirits, of course, exist beyond the categories of gender and binaries.
Mm.
I think this is something that people really need to consider when they're talking about this issue. And it's something that frequently gets lost because, especially when it's politicized, there's that tendency towards that very hard and extreme polarization. You know, there's only two genders kind of rhetoric. It's like, well, you know, it's not even entirely true to say there's only two sexes. Now, are there only two categories of the extreme ends of the gender, the masculine and the feminine? Sure. Are there ways in which they're fluid and intermediate in between? Yes, there's only the two opposites, but we still have that intermediate category going on. The ancients understood this.
I was going to say that, I mean, it depends what kind of angle we want to go in discussion from this. The thing I was going to say, actually, is that I find it quite interesting that Feiniger then, as Evola does as well, takes this idea and extends it actually to this informing your sexuality to some degree. The truest form of, you know, a companion bond is the combination of one individual and another individual who amongst them create a whole man and a whole woman in this sort of ideal sense. And that they, you know, be whatever these individuals are clarified in terms of biological terms or whatever else, just purely in a sort of abstract, they just add up to this total value of one on both sides, or they get close to it. And he sort of then goes into some quite interesting things about how, you know, overtly masculine men actually put off a large number of women because that masculinity that's that extreme actually has no relation to them, because they don't have, you know, that sort of feminine character of demeanor to reflect that in certain ways. And he even says that this is where you get these strange points of inversion, where actually the most masculine men are idealized and attracted by the most feminine men, not the most feminine women per se.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in the chat who seem to be not understanding the difference between talking about like physical sciences, biology, and talking about philosophy. And there's this idea that the quote-unquote the left has a monopoly on the idea of the human spirit in terms of male and female. It might be better not to say sex and gender, since those have become such loaded terms in a post kind of John Money world, but kind of, you know, there's the human body and the human spirit, and these things, yes. You know, if you believe in anything more than a completely physiocratic world, these two things are distinct, and it's, you know, the male body, but you may not feel like you have a male spirit, and not in like the gay, weird, I'm too spirit on Tumblr sense, but in the very, you know, like you said, the ancients understood this, that they understood that there were these weird, they're often depicted in myth, as you always talk about, Evelyn, you know, if you were born in like BC 2000, you'd be giving out secret knowledge from the sea. You'd be one of these androgynous, as they described it, kind of sexless, you know, mythological knowledge givers. They're very important in myths of most peoples in the world. And I think it's a great loss that a lot of people spurg out, really, about what is the empirical nature of things. You know, people saying the moon is no opposite to the sun, but, in, you know, like you talked about in astrology and in classical philosophy, it is. It's seen as it's, you know, Mars and Venus and all these different things, these philosophical, not physical opposites. I think it's very important that people understand the framing here, that you can talk about sex, sexuality, and the way that people feel about the masculine and the feminine in much more than a purely biological framework.
Well, I think Sorry, go ahead, Evan. Well, I was going to just quickly say And in that, we shouldn't allow ourselves to be dominated by just opposing what the leftists say, because I think so many people play into that, and they actually then coincidentally make some of the mistakes that are mentioned in here. But I'll let you go on further to your point.
Yeah, look, I think the politicization of it really results in people wanting to have a very narrow view, because they don't want anything that's going to challenge their ideological narrative around it. I really don't have any patience for that kind of thing, because it's like, well, you're not really interested in getting to the truth and actually coming to a deep understanding. You just want to promote an ideology. And I don't have a lot to talk about with people like that, I find. You know, I tend to want to approach these things with an open mind and, you know, asking the questions and considering it from a philosophical point of view does not mean you're promoting it or advocating for it in any way. But, you know, I don't see what benefit is gained by just outright denying some of these things because, you know, we're fighting some culture wars. Like, you know, the part of the problem is that the left is the only camp who is allowed to talk about these things in any way. And so they're, and it ends up being like this really like harsh dichotomy, where it's like both both sides are like trying to advance their political narrative, and it's not leaving any room for a more nuanced discussion that actually gets at something approximating the truth. And I like the way that Evola treats this, you know, to just, I don't know if people in the chat have read this chapter from The Bow and the Club. It's a pretty short chapter, but he starts off discussing, you know, homosexuality, saying, you know, it used to just be limited to the upper classes, and now it's affecting the lower classes, and only the middle class has been spared, which I think, you know, in 1958, that may have been true. We could perhaps dispute that now. It seems now that the middle class is almost the prime target. But he says that it's really difficult to elucidate the phenomenon of homosexuality. He puts it in the category of a pathology, but not because it offends bourgeois sensibilities. He relies heavily on the arguments he's made in Eros and the Mysteries of Love, where he's talking about this opposition, this polarity of the masculine and feminine. And he's saying that normal sexuality derives from the psychosexual states engendered by that polarity. And he's referring primarily to what is metaphysical rather than what's physical. He's, you know, we're not speaking here of biological men and women, but of the metaphysical concepts of masculine and feminine, and that these principles have a natural polarity, which we've already discussed. So he's saying, you know, you don't find absolute man or woman in nature, but you find humans in whom either the masculine or feminine principle predominates and still has the qualities of the opposite principle to a greater or lesser degree. And his view is that, you know, when two people get together, the sum of their respective masculine and feminine parts should add up to one whole absolute man and one whole absolute woman. So a man who's 75% masculine and 25% feminine is going to seek the opposite in a woman. And if he finds her, you know, they'll be magnetically drawn to each other. That's really going to ignite Eros between them. So this applies only to situations where Eros is involved, where there's this deep and fundamental eroticism. But he says it does not apply in cases where, you know, this sort of kind of modern love and sexuality that's been very degraded and watered down, that's just kind of an expression of bourgeois sentimentality. And he does allow for the fact that homosexuality could be the natural product of two people whose sex is not strongly differentiated. So for example, he is 55% masculine and 45% feminine, or vice versa. You know, you're really close to that 50% mark. And so he says that these poorly differentiated sexuations, as he calls them, could be associated with this concept of the third sex, but that these are really extreme cases. But for people who fit that category, then homosexuality may be in keeping with their inherent nature, and it would be unnatural to try to force them into something else. But I, you know, he seems to consider that this does not describe the majority of homosexual relations in the modern age. And then he takes us on a little journey through homosexuality in the classical world, saying that male homosexuality has always been regarded as morally worse than female homosexuality. You know, well, why would that be the case? Shouldn't they both be wrong? And he's like, well, no, the reason for this is that with two men, one of them has to be used as a woman. And so that's very degrading to him. But because woman's nature is inherently sexual, when two women do that, that's different. It's because the undercurrent of the feminine nature is sexuality. Women aren't degraded by partaking in that, provided, he gives the caveat, that the woman in question isn't LARPing at heterosexual sex where one woman's playing the part of the man. If they're both just, you know, indulging in their femininity, that's very different than with two men where one man is being forced to play the part of the woman. But he says that in the classical world that, you know, it wasn't the case until later times, these more decadent times, that the homosexual relationships between, for example, between an older man and an adolescent boy, he's like, you know, that wasn't about erotic attraction. It didn't involve penetrative sex. It was a form of trying to induce Eros without having a woman as the object. And the use of the adolescent boy was considered the very lowest degree of that. The highest way to induce Eros without a woman is just, you know, these feelings that you elicit through spiritual beauty. But you know, they certainly weren't sodomizing these young boys. That would have degraded the boy's dignity. You just wouldn't do that to him. To be used in that way was considered extremely shameful. So it was a form of platonic love, and part of the reason it was considered very pure was simply because it didn't have a woman as the object and it wasn't reproductive. Obviously, later on and in the more decadent stages, this was no longer the case. And then, you know, we get to the point where we're at now in the modern world. So he's saying that, you know, a lot of these types of homosexuality fall under this very abnormal category and are not being described, you know, under the principle of gender polarity.
It's in it's stronger coming out against the butches there than make the joke.
Mm. Well, no, I was going to say someone in chat is just saying, "Oh, spirit, what wisdom can you gift me?" Read Lenin. Sounds a bit right. No, I think the there is a point there though where people, as you're saying, they completely reject this view of a more, you know, as a sort of holistic view of both sex and sexuality that encompasses one within the other to a certain extent. If you really grasp what's going on. And that people seem to just knee-jerk against that in a sort of a weird kind of Darwinian utopian sort of thing of this doesn't fit my model of what, you know, a small slew of 19th century biologists told me men and women are. It seems to me it's so incredibly sort of ignorant in a certain sense. And especially when someone like Evola states the point he does, Iran, I know you've had this up on stream for a while. I don't know shall I start with the first section on and an egalitarian, and you can do the section if you want.
We've pretty much covered the point in the first bit between us, but yes, we'll do this section here because we've covered the points here, and where Evola's talking about the third sex, Philosocat, you actually covered those quite well. If you want to read the first section, I'll read the second section because it's quite an interesting little discussion here.
In an egalitarian and democratized society, in the broader sense of the term, in a society in which there are no longer any castes, functional organic classes or orders, in a society in which culture is standardized, extrinsic, utilitarian, and tradition is no longer a living, forming force, in a society in which Pindar's "be thyself" has become but a meaningless phrase. In a society in which character amounts to a luxury that only fools can afford, whereas in inner weakness is the norm. In a society, finally, in which whatever lies above racial, ethnic and national difference has been replaced by what effectively lies below all this, and which, therefore, has a shapeless and hybrid character. In such a society, forces are at work that in the long run are bound to influence the very constitution of individuals, thus affecting everything typical and differentiated, even in the psychophysical. Hopefully people were able to hear me towards...
Yes. I think it was just a second that OBS said it disconnected and instantly said it reconnected. I think there might actually just be some weird issue going on here with the newest version of OBS.
It glitched out for me there for just a second.
All right.
I heard everything that was said, but then there was a period of quiet.
Yeah, that's kind of... It should be okay. Try refreshing. I think that's definitely working now. Apologies, guys, we are having some technical issues, but we are soldiering on through. I'll read the second bar here. Democracy is not a mere political and social fact. It is a general climate which, in the long term, is destined to have regressive consequences on an existential level itself. In the particular domain of the sexes, it can promote the kind of inner decay, kind of weakening of the inner power of sexation that, as already noted, represents the premise for the emergence and spread of the third sex, and with it, of many truly striking forms of homosexuality in society. On the other hand, other consequences of all this is the visible trivialization and primitivization of normal sexual relations between young members of the latest generation, on account of reduced tension due to the lower degree of polarity. Even certain strange phenomena, which were apparently very rare in the past, such as sex changes, men taking on female bodies and vice versa, may be understood in the same terms and traced back to the same causes. It is, though, in today's general climate that potentialities of the opposite gender contained within each of us acquired an exceptional possibility of resurfacing and activating itself on account of the weakening of the central force, which even biologically defines one's type to the point of replacing and changing the sex one was born with. How oddly prophetic. That's oh no, it's the Evolian time machine now. It's interesting that we've got that. I'm just checking that's the end of the quote there. Because it relatively accurately describes some of the stuff we've been experiencing. The kind of the depolarizing and de-sexing in some ways of society with the crumbling of certain structures. And it's not him coming out and admonishing these people and saying these people are disgusting and blaming them and raging at them, really. He's very much extolling that these people are almost like not a natural product, but an inevitable product of this environment.
Did you guys read the chapter prior to this one, The Breed of Evasive
Man?
Well,
I was going to say, I've read the full The Poe and the Club. I have it downstairs. It's a book I quite enjoy. But no, one thing I'd thought about this is the fact that, you know, is what he is describing here on a kind of grander scale, because obviously I think the way that a lot of people react to something like this from Evola is they don't understand what he's talking about and how he approaches issues like these. You know, he's not describing something here that he just thinks has happened as of late or as good or as bad in a simplistic form. It is just the nature of the way the world is. It is how things are and it's how they will continue to be. Because looking through a long enough timeline, it just seems to be the case of what's happening. So in a certain sense, this is kind of like your Kali Yuga or entropy, where the physical information of male and female may actually just be breaking down.
What were you saying about the previous chapter?
That's sort of what he says. Yeah, he refers back to the previous chapter a couple of times, describing people as being this breed of evasive man, right? And he is saying, you know, this is just... He's not, as you say, he's not blaming anybody. This is just a natural consequence that comes with democracy. Democracy has this egalitarian and downward leveling. It's always going to have the tendency to promote inner decay. And Evola says that democracy represents the premise for the emergence of the third sex in the first place and all the various forms of what he calls sexual perversions. And, you know, if you look in the previous chapter on the breed of evasive man, he's talking about this. He's talking about how democracy inverts normal relationships because the sovereign, the monarch, is non-existent. So he's comparing the human organism to the organism of state and society. The king is non-existent. Direction and determination comes from below, comes from the masses. Well, this is true for this new breed of evasive man. He has no inner sovereign, and he's entirely dominated by all of his lower elements. And he's saying that this climate of democracy is necessarily going to exert this regressive influence on people, where liberation, as they, you know, it just amounts to the elimination of any kind of inner form or character or virtue. So there's this decline of inner sovereignty, and he's saying that this results in an unstable, formless type of person, and that's what he calls the breed of evasive man. So how does he describe it? He's like, well, the evasive man can't stand to have any kind of inner discipline. He hates the prospect of facing himself. He's incapable of any real serious commitment or of following any kind of code of conduct. He's feeble, evasive, lighthearted irresponsibility. He fails to act on promises, no matter how trivial. He's not punctual. He's forgetful and absent-minded. He has an inability to concentrate, and he has a natural tendency towards lying. And I'm sure we can all think, even just within the immediate circles of the people we know, more than one person who very well fits that definition. It's become so common these days. So this inner form that he's talking about that is being destroyed in this context, that inner form is going to contain, among other things, the predominant gender, which is determined by biological sex. And so he's saying when that inner form breaks down, when it weakens sufficiently, then the traits of the latent gender start to emerge, even to the point where it can be the case that one no longer identifies with the physical sex they were born as. And so he's saying, like, as people get, you know, more and more into this, being this type of evasive man, as it becomes more and more prevalent throughout society, you're just going to see, you know, more gender confusion, more unnatural relationships or inability to even have relationships, because, you know, who wants to be in a relationship with somebody who, you know, lies and can't keep their promises? So he's kind of saying, you know, this, the prevalence of homosexuality, transgenderism, etc., is a symptom, but not a cause. And it's an expected symptom. It's not, you know, it's not something we should be surprised by.
Well, I just think you can look at the, I mean, he uses the term democracy in the latter section, but I think the more important term actually is democratization. Because what he's talking about there is the opening of access to, even in a very primitive sense, you know, resources. You know, once you have, say, a large enough division of labor that you no longer have a hunter-gatherer society, women's tastes tend to follow for no longer, you know, physical strength or physical prowess that would grant you a greater bag at hunting. Instead, it's now going for someone who's maybe slightly more clever or is no longer exuding maybe, you know, a high ideal of masculinity or a really high level of that, because it was required for them to go out and do what was needed. And now, as you move into even further and further into like industrialized society, you would get to the point where women's sexual preferences have completely moved away from the biological health of men. Whereas, because I think this is something I actually came across, I think both in Weiniger and in a different paper I was reading, but generally, men throughout history have always picked women by how healthy they are, by how, in a certain sense, by how sexed they are in regards to female, because that indicates that they are more fertile, they'll be better at rearing kids, this, that, and the next. And that hasn't actually changed for the most part. Whereas in terms of the dimorphism, not just within men and women, but within men as a category on its own, that has actually skewed towards people who are good material producers and furthermore to good material managers. And I think that almost sort of explains, in a certain sense, like the looks you get from folk on Twitter who think they're like really cool or hip or attractive men, and they actually become sort of very effeminate, basically middle manager characters, is quite strange. But that seems to be what women go for to a certain extent.
Well, I think when you start to have this breakdown of the gender polarity and you get men becoming more feminized and women becoming more masculinized, you know, you're starting to, it becomes very difficult to find somebody with whom you can add up to the sum of, you know, one absolute man and one absolute woman that doesn't almost involve a complete gender reversal. It's almost like we're nearing the stage where the polarity is about to flip even. You know, the Jungians describe this as like anima and animus possession, which is a very similar concept where, you know, the idea that when a man's anima, his female nature, isn't integrated, it's going to wreak havoc in his life, and it basically turns him into, you know, a wimpy guy who just doesn't know how to take action in the world, or he's very like moody or emotional, can't really find the energy to do what needs to be done, or is overly impulsive. And guys like this tend to end up in relationships with animus possessed women who are kind of the opposite. You know, there are these, I mean, they're bitches, basically. I hate to use the phrase, but they are.
Is it virago or something? It's another term. Basically, like you're talking about sort of like the
shrew.
Sort of big framed women who are essentially going to mother.
They're also called animus hounds. Like there are these they have a really unhealthy relationship with their own femininity. And so they end up being very vulnerable to being animus possessed. They tend to have very negative images about femininity, very highly critical of other women. And they're just like, they can be like these bossy, you know, they're the girl bosses. They're the corporate.
I'm trying to find the image. There's this great stereotypical image of like the tiny soyjack male and the big framed kind of overweight, very aggressive, very domineering, very controlling woman. Like the modern kind of weird couple dynamic, which is really what you're talking about. And I cannot find this meme anywhere.
With the men who are like anima possessed, they tend to be the quintessential male feminist, right? They have a really unhealthy relationship with their own masculinity. So they're leaning too much into the feminine, but they're doing it in like this kind of unintegrated, unconscious sort of shadow type of way. And, you know, it's just, you get these such unhealthy relationship dynamics, but I'm sure we can all think of somebody in our lives we know where like there's a couple with like, the weak feminist man who's married to the girl boss, who's got the corporate career and earns more than he does and just bosses him around all the time. Like, I can't count the number of couples I've met like that. And it seems to be becoming this incredibly prevalent thing. And then, so, I mean, and that's the state of heterosexual relationships right now. So to say nothing of any other type.
Well, I've just got, I've got this image up on stream currently because it's the closest thing I can think of.
Yes.
I also previously had the Soyjack Nintendo Labo, the Nintendo, when you were talking about the weak, easily led, indecisive men. That is the Soyjack. But sorry, go on, Evelyn.
Well, no, obviously this is something that like I brought up in one of AE's streams the other week, and got slightly chinned by people in the chat, but I think some people understood what I was suggesting. But the one that always struck me is the men who have an aesthetic appreciation for women and a specific type of form. It seems so odd to me. You know, they're selecting through, you know, a brochure of different types of women, like women would look through like a curtain catalogue or something. It's so twee and strange, and it's something that I just can't grasp at all. Because it's like there's been friends of mine that I had that are male that are just like women. And that makes a lot more sense to me than the ones are like, oh, well, I need X, Y, or Z specific type of woman. And, you know, it's not to, I mean, I suppose part of the whole thing in Sex and Character is that he's essentially talking about stereotypes, but it's very stereotypically sort of particular in a neurotic sort of female attitude. And it, you know, it is one of those things I find rather strange that, despite, say, all the
stereotypes do have a basis in reality.
Yeah,
like I think, stereotypes don't just come from nowhere.
No, exactly. But I find it very strange that I actually feel that someone like myself is makes much more sense in regards to character than a lot of the people who you would think of as sort of stereotypical heterosexual men or stereotypical heterosexual women, who are maybe not as much of a genetic mess as myself, and because of that, are struggling more with, you know, say they're, for the sake of argument, not 50-50 or whatever variation, but they're closer to like a, you know, a 60-40 or 65-35. And because of that, as you're saying, there's just enough of a latent thing that it creates someone who is, you know, very sort of mood swings and picky and can be very difficult. And I think that would work for either end. I think, furthermore, there's an interesting thing in Weiniger as well, where he goes on to talk about how many of the people who are geniuses of different periods vary in regards to either being highly sexuated towards their own sort of biological character or, you know, actually varying heavily the other way. I mean, he talks at one period about how you can look at a lot of the great European composers with all, for the most part, very sort of feminine, sort of dandy kind of men. And then you have, I think the sort of other thing that he talks about as an example of that is the sort of women's liberation movements and women's emancipation movements, and that, you know, the men who were composers were in a certain sense trying to appreciate beauty in a way that, or just try and sort of exemplify and express beauty in a way that women would, maybe with their form or with just their being in general, and that they're trying to do that through an art form because they couldn't otherwise, and that vice versa, you know, feminists are women who are trying to express their own sort of masculine want to conquer and essentially be imperial.
Mm-hmm.
I found that a very interesting.
Art in general is like, art is inherently Venusian. It's inherently feminine.
Mm.
So there has to, because you can't, a man has to be somewhat in touch with his feminine side in order to produce good art, like art that's actually aesthetically pleasing and that instills like a sense of beauty and wonder in those who partake of it, as opposed to, you know, a lot of modern art, which is really just for shock value. But when we're talking about real art that's meant to be beautiful, you know, you really have to be able to channel something feminine in order to create that.
Oh, there we go.
Again, have we?
No. We're fine. There was just a bit of an awkward pause there, I guess.
Oh, fair enough.
Everyone can still hear each other, right? Everyone's getting paranoid now. It's the tech issue thing. No, it's again, it's the idea that you're right. In spirit, when he talks about the women becoming men to subsume kind of the male attitude, or artists becoming feminine, there are like you talked about, the animus of art and nature and things is always seen in basically every culture as feminine. It's seen as a,
well, and that's not to say that artists are feminine.
No.
A very masculine, you can still be a very masculine man with a healthy sense of beauty, but it's just that, you know, you've successfully managed to integrate that feminine part of you, and not allow it to be a destructive force, but instead a creative force. And, you know, that's just typically not what we see, especially when we look at modern art nowadays. You can really tell like what a person's like psychological state is by the type of art they want to create, you know. So when you see a lot of like song lyrics or the type of imagery that's painted and stuff like that, you're just kind of like, what is going on with this person? Like, why? Like, they tend to be really like depressing, low vibe themes. And it's really rare now to see any kind of art that's like very spiritually beautiful or inspiring in any way. So I think, you know, we're seeing this case. It's just another case of like that unhealthy relationship with the feminine. And it's like, you know, both men and women have an unhealthy relationship with the feminine as well as with the masculine. Like, it's and you especially see this maybe to the extreme among like the typical homosexuals, where like you know, the lesbians really, really hate men and the gays really, really hate women, despite the fact that they're both kind of LARPing as the opposite sex. And it's like, could you get a more like caricatured example of anima and animus possession? And it's almost like, I have wondered if it's the case where it's just such a strong case of like an anima or animus possession that's causing this outward homosexual expression, but perhaps they're not, like, from a sexual standpoint, from an erotic standpoint, not actually homosexual. But it's just a case of this extreme and irrational rejection of the opposite gender within them.
I also think part of it is jealousy. There's probably a great degree of jealousy when somebody kind of wants to fill that female role in a social way, but somebody does it naturally. You get a lot of that with what's referred to as the good old-fashioned troon rage, where you get people who are failing to fill that role when they want to. It's probably a combination of both the things, but it's, I don't think a lot of people, again, the discussion of like the animus of the man and woman is very far removed from the discussion that, again, some people seem to be insisting on having in the chats occasionally. But it is worthwhile.
Yeah, what is going on in the chat? Oh my gosh!
it's fine. It's a little bit better than it was. Some of you guys are doing okay there, but yes, anima and anime are related words. For those saying, it sounds kind of gay to me. That's a pretty good comment. I forgot to shill, honestly, but we do have a link down below to the Streamlabs, if you guys want to send questions and stuff to us. I will make sure we're not echoing when I quickly click on this, but we do have I forgot to the normal YouTube-y stuff, since we ended up getting the mute at the beginning, but we are actually monetized as well, just to do the normal shilling. That does help the metrics of the channel. I know it's kind of gay YouTube stuff, but that is true. What I currently have on screen, by the way, is possibly the worst piece of modern art that I can think of, which is Tracy Emin's unmade bed. It is literally an unmade bed, put in an art museum. It's not even like it's like the blank canvas called Take the Money and Run. It's not even vaguely clever. It's just a grotesque unmade bed as an artistic statement. But I'll, sorry, I'll let you get back to your point there. I just thought I'd go through some of the stuff that was lopped off the front of the stream.
Yeah, look, I think maybe we need to just clarify. People in the chat seem to be having a difficult time understanding just the metaphysical concepts of masculine and feminine as separate from biological man and biological woman. I feel like we explained that relatively well. I'm not really sure what to say to people who still don't get it.
They're just
do my
not
best,
get it.
But
that's the point.
Just,
what we do is we continue to talk about it in more and more abstract and complex
you know,
forms
and,
until they get
but
annoyed.
This is, it's a common thing, right? It, like you see this all the time, and it really hinders discussion of these kinds of topics because people get locked into this, and you do tend to find, I would say, it tends to be more prevalent among men than women, but like this kind of prickliness around the suggestion that a man could have anything feminine about him and this total rejection of that. And it's like, dude, you are putting yourself at great risk of anima possession if you are not already. Like, it's just the idea that in order to be a manly man, you have to reject everything feminine and saying like, art is definitely not feminine. It's like, yes, it is. It's everything that's Venusian, everything related to beauty is inherently feminine. That doesn't mean only women partake in it. It means that men who are, you know, can integrate that in a healthy way can produce really beautiful art as well. But it's still taking something of that metaphysical feminine principle.
But I was going to say, there's some of the chat seems to be like, well, there's no epistemological justification for it. It's just like, well, epistemology is not what we're doing here. And even then, I don't think you're quite right with that claim.
No, the issue is that people want to do biology when you're doing philosophy, and they can't separate the two.
One thing I want to consider, though, is that the claim is always bandied about by similar people who happen to have the opinions you were discussing previously, that I can understand what they're saying in some parts, that like the LGBT agenda is part of transhumanism because it's about changing yourself. But in that very same vein, their attitude's about, you know, well, let's just eradicate any and all non-ideal males and non-ideal females or people who believe in those things. You know, that's that same sort of want to change thing. So how would we even begin to parse really what isn't sort of an authentic expression of one's nature? I mean, that's one of the things I've always tried to get across to people when they, you know, try and pick a sort of bone with me, is that, you know, well, you're going against your nature, you're going against biology, that. It's like, well, I'm not really, because I'm almost completely unsituated as a man for the most part, and I know how I feel about myself better than I think anyone else does. So not to say that, you know, that it then goes and justifies all the nonsense ideology. I have no interest in that whatsoever, and I've said that time and time again. But, you know, if we're meant to be authentic to ourselves as people, and if that is the thing that ties us into the real world against, you know, the modern world of the hyper-real or whatever you want to call it, then, you know, how are we going to parse that someone like myself exists in a certain sense? I mean,
well,
this,
you know,
didn't seem
Evelyn,
to be
like
a problem, you know, 2,000 years ago, because you had the class of people that was called eunuchs, or the class of people that was a third sex, or androgyn, or whatever term they had for it. So it's almost kind of, you know, is this just a pure product of politicization, or is this because the actual mass of people themselves who would be both, or who would normally typically think of themselves as male and female, are also falling under this effect of democracy, as Evola has discussed? And as you said, are sort of rejecting the growing extra part within themselves as either more masculine or more feminine.
Well, the way I would answer that, and I don't know your personal story, I wouldn't presume to guess at that or to make assumptions about why you've made the decisions you've made and what's prompted them. But to speak from a very broad and general perspective, one thing that people really need to keep in mind is that living in line with your nature has very little to do with what you do to your body necessarily. Like, your body is just the way that your atoms are temporarily arranged in this material existence, but you exist eternally outside of that, beyond that. And this over-identification with our material bodies, which is again a product of like an atheistic democratic society, is prompting people to be like, oh, I need to, the only way I can feel like myself is to drastically change the way I look. And it's like, but that's really more a sign of being very out of touch with yourself. If you feel like, oh, in order for me to feel like I am who I am, I have to get a sex change and I feel like I was born in the wrong body. It's kind of looking at it from the wrong perspective. Like, maybe you feel more feminine when you have a man's body or vice versa, but what is your true nature has, like, it has very little to do with the type of body you have. Now,
sure that's the case. And this is something, Jess were actually talking about, because I think the concept of sex is a purely material concept. I mean, this is part of the thing we were talking about before, and I think Scrump kind of mentioned somewhat that, you know, is sex something that goes beyond material? Is there a spiritual aspect to it? At which point then, you know, maybe the want to make your material sex line up with, in theory, your spiritual sex, is there not, would there not be some sort of dissociative feeling there, or sort of anguish because of that? I'm not really sure.
Well,
because it would require us working out what the case is with the existence of sex outside of the material form.
Okay, but remember what Evel said. If we go with what Evel is saying as kind of the authority in this conversation, I guess, he's saying that feeling is going to occur when that predominating gender within you, what you were born with, is weakening due to that regression, that democratic leveling that's internal, and then the latent traits of that opposite gender emerge. So then what's going to happen is you have a person who was, let's say, born male, and the inner form has collapsed, and so now all these female traits are emerging. There's nothing to hold them back anymore, or what's trying to hold them back simply isn't sufficient to the job. Now you've got a man who's like, oh, but I feel like a woman. Why doesn't my body match what I feel? And it's like, but it's not a case that means you should be a woman. It means you need to build up your internal form and then bring these elements back into harmony. Now, it is possible that, you know, based on, you know, what he's saying about democracy having this tendency to promote that inner decay, that it is always going to have this regressive effect on humanity, it is natural that we should find a great many and an increasing number of people feeling this way.
I think the...
I mean, that's what Evelyn would say about it anyway.
I think the point with the reconciling of this is that there are, you know, you've never been a particularly masculine man, and a lot of the time you do see, I did mention the Troon, but you do see these people who are very obviously highly sexed male, who are attempting to turn themselves into something a lot more feminine. It seems that most people who start from more of a quote-unquote genuine in terms of maybe biological standpoint on this are always very extremely effeminate men, and they have those very effeminate aspects about them to begin with.
This brings us all the way back around to the sort of idea of the intermediate form, though. You know, if we are an intermediate form to some degree, then again, how does this interplay with how you are on a sort of either spiritual or subconscious level, whatever you want to describe the higher self from the sort of lower form self, you know. But I mean, it's something that I'm asking about, because again, we as a sort of people who engage in material probably haven't really done the thinking we need to on it. So I'm just more interested really in asking the questions.
to quickly sum up what I think, the way I'd read of all it is that he's saying that the epidemic of it, the widespread nature of it, the increasing nature of it, of a phenomenon that has always existed and probably will always exist, as kind of the people who exist on like the alternate trans YouTube talk about that, it is in the past has been an extremely niche topic that a very small number of people suffer from, because they have these, you know, these differences. They might be biological, they might be, you know, know, spiritual, they could be whatever, but it's a very small problem. And the way that we see it thrust into wider society is what's causing the imbalance. And the decay of that, and the idea that we have this increasing and the spread of the third sex. He's not saying it's emerging because of this. He's saying it's spreading because of this. It's a phenomenon that's being amplified rather than being created by it. Anyway, that's my two cents.
The third sex. You guys are getting laid more than twice.
You know, I mean, to just kind of take a step back and look at this from a more spiritual perspective, right? Everybody's like, well, I want my body to match what's inside me, and who am I really? Like, everybody has these questions about their identity. It's not a new thing for people to ask themselves, well, who am I really? And what tends to happen, the mistake that people always make, is they attach their identity to material things. For example, if I say, well, who am I? Well, I'm Kat, and I'm a woman, and I have blonde hair, and I'm a singer, and I love cats, and I have a lip balm addiction. Like, all of these are things that are extraneous, and they're not really me. The question I would then have to say is, like, well, who am I if I take away all of these things? Can I describe myself without reference to anything material? And most people's answer to that is no. They have no idea who they are if you strip all that away. And in fact, doing so is a very scary prospect for them, because what most people will find is that actually there's nothing left to them if they strip that away. They've put so much effort into identifying with material things that they've completely neglected their higher self. Now, what you tend to find when you start investing in getting to know your higher self, and then that's what you become identified with rather than the material aspects of your body and the rest of your life, then you can kind of have an equanimity with your material circumstances, with your body. I mean, I'm not in some ways the most feminine woman. I have very overdeveloped masculine traits in some ways. You know, in the past, I guess I would say, like, when I was younger, I probably suffered from a lot of, like, the classic animus possession symptoms. You know, I did have that really unhealthy relationship with my femininity as a result. And I was just like, I never questioned, like, if I was in the wrong body or the wrong gender, but I was very rejecting of the feminine. And I was like, oh, I'm not like other girls. And I was very critical of any of that. And I didn't want to do anything that seemed girly. And I was just like, I only wanted to hang out with other guys, not because I like wanted sexual attention. I just wanted to be considered one of the guys. And while it didn't enter into my head that, oh, maybe I'm transgender, because that wasn't a thing back then, really, I still felt like my place was with the guys. And you know, in hindsight, looking at that, I'm like, well, I did have this very unhealthy relationship with my feminine side. And it was something that I only brought back into balance by first recognizing that it was a problem. And then second, really actively working to bring out that feminine side and to integrate it a little bit more. And it's like, well, the masculine side of me, I'm always going to be more masculine than the average woman in some ways, probably. Like, it's just who I am. It's just a quality that I was born with. The intellectualism. Intellectualism is a very masculine type of activity, as opposed to like the more feeling side that's feminine, right? So it's kind of like, well, I like that about me. I don't want to get rid of that. Like, I consider that an asset. But at the same time, my ability to use my intellect effectively is actually being hindered by the fact that I'm not bringing into balance the more feeling side of myself. So, I mean, I don't know how you feel about that, Evelyn, how that might kind of play into your own story and the way that you view things or not. But I put it out there for just a little bit of perspective, I guess.
Well, no, it's it's weird when you say that, because I mean, it's obviously maybe obvious that I either carry over a similar trait of that kind of, you know, the intellectualism of actually wanting to engage with ideas and think of the abstract, which, as you said, is an explicitly male thing. And I don't really feel, I don't feel dissociative when I engage in activity like that. But there are things that, you know, when I was a child that I did, I felt sort of a dissociative kind of thought or sort of feeling around them, because and in some sort of deeper sense, it didn't feel right. And I know that's not like very specific language, but I don't know. It's just it's a very strange thing. And again, it's as I think is why we need to possibly have sort of more discussions and sort of elaborate on it, because it's not, we've not got it all sussed. And it is sort of one of those things where, again, the question always comes back to me of, you know, how do we even begin to understand the binary of sex or ideal types in sex without that material form? Because surely the only need for opposing sex amongst, you know, conscious beings is the need to procreate. So there is all sorts of material necessities and effects that drive then your understanding of yourself. I mean, as someone said in the chat, I find that idea of trying to describe yourself without reference to material is probably extremely difficult, because we don't live in a spiritual world in any way, shape or form. We only live in a very sort of shallow and self-interested form, and it tends to be one that worships the material in some sort of full spiritual form. So it,
right,
as you
but
said,
we don't have to choose to participate in that on an internal level.
I don't think you're really given much of a choice, because there's no other way to understand or express yourself without these things, because the mechanisms by which we used to engage in that, be them, you know, hunter-gathering societies or early agricultural societies or industrial society, you know, each of those different stages, the ways in which men have discovered themselves as men and women have discovered themselves as women has probably varied massively. And it is, you know, we've maybe sort of come past and are beyond the pale, because these things are now, they are always first and foremost ideas. They are not expressed
One of the other problems would be that if you could describe yourself in non-physiocratic terms, the majority of people would have trouble understanding what you mean. It's baked in the way that we communicate, and we are products of our time. To get back to some of the discussion about reconciling the two, you know, there's a good discussion to be had here, really, about the point that a lot of it is made very physical, but nobody really, you know, in our supposedly like super duper trans tolerant society is anyway having a discussion about how people internally reconcile those feelings. There's very little emphasis on, I know, a process that you've done quite heavily, which is thinking, reaching within yourself and seeing how you feel about things. And it all does become the physical, it all becomes, you know, surgical. In the idea that there can be, and the majority of people out there might need to learn that they need to be happy being somewhat androgynous, and that they'll never reach that ideal point, and that's okay.
It is okay, because we're not supposed to reach the ideal point, and you can't have a spectrum if you don't have people solidly in the middle, keep building a bridge between the two. I mean, I don't know, Evelyn, like, what would you consider yourself percentage-wise, like masculine versus feminine? I think I would say I'm like 70% feminine, 30% masculine. How would you categorize yourself?
I don't really know, because then you would have to then go through all the characteristics and define them one way or another. And
I mean, just like your gut estimate, like, do you feel like you're kind of very 50-50?
At least that, I would say. I mean, I think, especially when it comes to sort of more, shall we say, sort of intimate or subjective things about how you interact within social circles where you naturally fit in hierarchies. You know, the one I always began to notice as into my late teens was the way that male friends would act around me, especially if they were alone, as opposed to them interacting with me in a group. It was always very different, because obviously I was carrying some sort of nascent, you know, female traits in regards to my attitude about things and the way that I carried myself and the way that I maybe looked to some extent. So I think it you are possibly as much either part as you recognize in that moment. I mean, one of the things I was actually going to think about and possibly add to the conversation was, you know, is maybe one of the non-material aspects of that then is how your own understanding of yourself comes in interplay with sort of intimacy or romance. And that, you know, you were said before this idea of the homosexuality in Evola where that someone is forced to play the position of the woman. Well, what if they're not forced? What if they're happy to do because that's where they feel their place is?
Right. And then I think the question Evola would ask is, do you feel that's your place because of the collapsing of the inner form that would otherwise have masculine traits at the forefront? And is it because those masculine traits have collapsed that the feminine has become predominant? Or is it the case of what he's talking about where you actually are just, you know, very undifferentiated? There's a kind of this even balance of masculine or feminine, or maybe even tending more towards the feminine naturally. So I guess we're the question is that really your natural and inherent state, or is it due to the collapse of that inner form that he's talking about? Because he's kind of giving two different categories here.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think I ever had that inner form to rely on, if that makes sense. So I think I've always been in a position of, you know, I think probably a very high level of neutrality. And that can be seen in a number of places in regards to things I've discovered about from the doctors in regards to bone density and all sorts of developmental problems. So it very much makes sense. And it comes
back. And it could even be a combination of the two, right? Like it could be that you were born as, like, say, 55% masculine, 45% feminine, and then due to the, you know, the environment of the modern world that you've been raised in, the inner form of the masculine also then started to collapse too, and it was never particularly strong to begin with. So there could be like this interplay of both of these factors. I don't think it necessarily has to be an either or, like he's describing it.
I
would actually imagine that in practice that there probably is an overlap between the two cases that he's describing.
Shall we say the other way I've always sort of seen it is if I was a hairy chested big bloke and I went in the pub and I did all sorts of big blokey things, the last thing I would really want to be grouped in is an understanding of man that also includes someone like myself.
Yes, but those men tend to have really unhealthy attitudes towards their own inner feminine. And it's really funny because there's so many of these like men who are like, you know, going around saying men, like they're just, you know, beating their chest about their manhood. But then they're like the quickest to throw a temper tantrum.
Well,
like,
what
and
I'm saying
it's
is
like
more
they
the
have
fact
no
that
control over their emotions.
If they are close to the ideal type, closer to the ideal type, and that's the thing they idolize. You know, that, you know, everyone exists on the spectrum, but the vast majority of people look towards the types. Then
yes, but then I don't see why they would feel threatened by that, because a man who's approaching, you know, the state of absolute man is secure in himself, and there's no reason to feel threatened by somebody who's on a different part of the spectrum.
It's
kind of like, well, why are they reacting so strongly? And I mean, in many cases it is projection.
I think what Evelyn means is that in terms of like masculinity, in terms of defining masculinity, that if you go by this binary man-man, you know, man is man, woman is woman, there's nothing in between, that you can definitely see that there are manly men and effeminate men. These things exist, and they very, very clearly exist. You can see that, you know, one man is a lot more effeminate than another man, even without all the trappings of the modern world. Even without, you know, the medicalization of it, for example. I think that's kind of what you're getting at, that the idea of all biological men inherently being masculine and any non-masculine traits in them being abhorrent would be bizarre to someone who is actually masculine, because they can understand that there is such a thing as a more feminine man.
Right, but let's keep in mind that one of Evola's premises, which he doesn't go into too much in this essay, but goes into extensively in Eros and the Mysteries of Love, is this concept of this primordial unity between masculine and feminine, that they were once combined in the same principle, and it was, and they became split, right? So there's, he says, you know, erotic love is about seeking that unity again, right? So what I found, and this maybe echoes a little bit what somebody said in the comments, Samantha Swordflame said, I've found that in transitioning male to female, I've also had to learn what it means to be a man. It's hard to convey to anyone else. Well, you know, when I was going through the process of trying to come to terms and make peace with my femininity and integrate that in a healthier way, and then put the masculine aspects of myself back into proper balance, what I found was that I got to a place where I really no longer cared what other people thought of me. I wasn't comparing myself to other women anymore at all. Like, if they're more feminine than me or less feminine, like, I don't care. Like, we are the way that God made us, right? And it is in that integration that I felt like, okay, I'm becoming, you know, more of a whole person in that sense. There's that unity that's happening, that grasping back at that union of the masculine and feminine, that alchemical marriage within yourself. And I don't think that, you know, anybody can do that, really. Like, you can integrate both of those within yourself. And it's not a case of, you know, I've never said to myself, how do I be the most feminine woman I can possibly be? Because being absolute woman isn't about rejecting and purging my masculine qualities. Absolute woman is simply a platonic form that is describing a metaphysical principle, but it is not what we are meant to be as human beings. That's not what we are meant to strive for. We should be striving towards this holistic unity, and accepting with equanimity the life that we've been given, the bodies that God has given us, and playing the part that we have, because all of us are unique, whether somebody's 80% masculine or 50% masculine or 20%, like, it, you know, you need all types to make the spectrum. We need all types in order to be able to move fluidly across and to be able to experience that whole spectrum, because these metaphysical concepts of masculine and feminine are there for us all to partake in different degrees. We're not meant to completely reject the other, because that results in a very unbalanced and unhealthy person. And this is what you tend to see with people who become very over-identified with their gender expression or their sexuality, is a really strong rejection of what they don't want to be. You know, they don't want to be seen as the manly man or the feminine woman, or like, there's this mishmash, and it's just kind of this really bizarre combination of different characteristics in an attempt to like embrace one and reject the other, but almost in a way that's a little bit forced. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure if I'm explaining it properly, but there's something that's a bit affected about it.
Yeah, a bit performative. You do get people who try and over. Before we get a bit too long and too sorry, we did get
like, it's not the essence.
We did get
the genuine essence is lacking.
We did get a super chat about 20 minutes ago. I couldn't find anybody to fit it in, but I'll read it before we get a bit too long in the tooth here. To Kat, have you ever read The Origins and History of Consciousness? If so, what do you think? If not, I would recommend it. That's from Orange Team. Thank you for the €5.
I have not read it. I have not heard of it. So you'll have to tell me the author.
I'm not sure. Yeah, if you put it in the chat, Orange Team, I'm sure we can try and figure out what that is. But I've never heard of that either. So it's not anything anyone here has read, unfortunately. I think that's the only donation
we're
that
not,
we got, though.
We're not erudite enough.
No, I'm afraid we're not erudite
enough.
Yes,
I believe so.
I think there's a couple more things I want to go through. Though we talked about the spirit here quite a lot, but there are some possibly physiocratic reasons we might be seeing an emergence of more androgynous people too.
We'll see. I think possibly for the sake of, because no offense to you, it's just questions that sort of came up to me in the top of my head that I was asking. I think possibly some of those are maybe more of a biological or ethnological or, well, you know, there's another term I'm trying to look for there that I can't think of. But it's more of a material study. I'd love to see what Ed Dutton's opinion is on some of that.
It all went a bit funny. There we go. We should be back. I'll get people to refresh. Just want to white restart that point. There we go. People should refresh.
No, I was just going on to say the fact that I actually emailed an endocrinologist about this sort of phenomena of what I referred to as sort of de-sexing, or, you know, this lowering sexual dimorphism amongst people in regards to what we see as lower testosterone counts in men, or the increased take-up of menopause treatment amongst women in both larger numbers and at a younger age, which would indicate that their natural ability to produce estrogen in some way, shape, or form is not what it was before. However, you cannot find studies that talk about this. You can find loads and loads of studies that talk about testosterone lowering, and they will debate the amount, whether it's 50% in such a year, or 22%, or 29%, whatever it is. But there seems to be an agreed sort of sentiment that that's decreasing. Yet there seems to be no studies into the estrogen counts and what's going on with those. But when I emailed an endocrinologist about it, he basically just told me media hype. So I think, Scrump, you've taken that as an opportunity to possibly suggest that there might be some forbidden science that might be required to doing to there actually uncover what's going on with this stuff.
There doesn't appear to be any studies that debunk it. It just seems that an area that hasn't been studied, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. I know there was the famous case where some BuzzFeed journalists got their T count taken, and it was like beyond abnormally low. It was like really, 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 really bad. Which, aside from being just kind of funny, also might show that there is a problem in certain sections of the male population rather than a universal problem. But it's an interesting viewpoint. We've covered more, like you said, the philosophical aspects of it, but it also might be that we see some of this androgenizing of people in an actual physical way due to their hormones and due to their diets, and possibly due to their genetics from their environment as well. It's something I wanted to ask you, Philosocat, but when did you get into more esoteric things like Evola and some of them? I know a lot of people don't. I know you've read it, Evelyn. You've obviously read The Bow in the Club because we've been discussing it today. But when I broached this subject to some of AA's audience, for example, there were people I don't know if they were doing it jokingly or not, like screaming and cursing and saying, "Oh, Evola endorsing this idea of the third sex is terrible. I can't read him now," and things like that. But
oh my god. Yes, because he acknowledges the existence of it, it's just too threatening to the narrative. So see, let's cancel Evola. That's not a good thing by me.
That's a good thing by me. We don't want these ideas mainstreamed into some sort of indiscernible nonsense.
No, we don't want ideas mainstream that are like promoting the kind of degeneracy that we see around it. But I think simply just acknowledging that there are people like this out there, like, it's just objective truth, you know? The fact is, there are a lot of people who are gender confused, and we could debate all day as to the reasons and causes behind that. But whatever the reasons are, the fact is they exist. Homosexuals exist. Intersex people exist. Like, to completely ignore that and not talk about it, I don't see how that's helpful. And we can have conversations about it that don't involve like promoting it and advocating it to children or suggesting that this should be normal in any way. But, you know, there's always going to be people who don't fit the norm. And, you know, the fact that they exist, like, that's okay. You know, it's when they go out and have their pride parades or they're grooming children that it's a problem. But I don't have and I don't think Evelyn would have a problem with the fact that somebody like you, Evelyn, exists, or somebody like Yiz. Just because somebody is suffering from, or not even necessarily suffering, but is, you know, one of these intermediate types for whatever reason, like, you know, you guys are allowed to exist. And I don't see how ignoring that or denigrating people like that for something that they don't have a lot of control over, I don't see how that's a helpful addition to any kind of meaningful conversation. Again, like, we're interested in getting at the truth here. And you know, it's maybe not a desirable condition for people, but they've always been around. And Evola acknowledging the intermediaries, it's no different than what the ancients did. I mean, he's drawing from that. He didn't just come up with this idea on his own. This is an idea that's been around for some time.
Well, see, that's what I find so sort of strange about it now, though. I think maybe it's that old classic thing that we like to lament about, but is still always true, that I think the people existing on the internet, identity being such, you know, an explicitly political thing and not something that we, you know, and I don't mean identity in that sense of some faux thing, but I mean who you actually are, what makes up the component parts that is you. These things are so sort of explicitly political, and that people are choosing aspects of that to pick and put together so that they can form this perfect version of themselves that is going to be great for political activity or whatever, you know, LARP they choose to believe in or strive for. And that combined with the fact that these people don't live in the real world, they don't recognise, and because quite ultimately, no matter what leftist propagandists try to say and what other crap statistics try to say, people like me are not common. And that can, you know, I experience that day in, day out when I actually go out and interact with people in the real world who aren't just like internet addicts. You know, I am a novelty to them, and that's not just a good thing or a bad thing. They just recognise the difference. Whereas people who are, you know, they're on Telegram consuming basically 2-minute hate content about the LGBT all day, then it's no wonder that they come at the subject of masculinity, femininity, and possibly people who are a mix of the two in some blend, as with all, so many preconceived notions that it basically makes conversation impossible. You get the exact same phenomena on race. You get the exact same phenomena on something like even maybe economics to some extent, when you're discussing about the nature of man and you try and talk to people who are like really hardcore national socialists. So it's, you know, these are the problems we have over a whole course of issues. I think this is just one of the ones where one of the least amount of work and the least amount of conversation has actually been had. And I think that's why it is so difficult to even, you know, even try to bring up the topic in certain places and, you know, banned, you know, arguments. You get people just posting shit memes or just giving you out and out vitriol.
The thing is, you know, the intermediate type people kind of by default end up roped into the left because the left kind of declares themselves as like the advocates for the LGBT crowd. And so politically they kind of end up getting sucked into that. And I think the rhetoric from the right about LGBT people pushes them into that camp even further and doesn't really allow there to be LGBT people who aren't left-wing or who can find a political home somewhere else in a way that doesn't, because if you're one of those people and you're forced into left-wing identity politics, it's only going to drive you deeper and deeper into identifying with your sexual identity. It's actually not helpful, not to mention the victim mentality that they tend to attach to it as well. Whereas, you know, if the right wing could find a way of interacting with people like this in a way that's not just mean. Like, it's past just like being offensive or insulting. It's downright nasty sometimes. Like, and I'm thinking like, well, if I were one of these LGBT people, I wouldn't want anything to do with the right wing. I guess even though I disagree with a lot of stuff on the left, I'll just stay here where at least I'm not being attacked every day, you know? So there needs to be a way for these people to kind of politically find a home somewhere else, which I think allows for a healthier expression of whatever it is they are or are doing, and even the possibility for some of them to come around and realize, well, maybe that's not what they actually want to be doing. But as long as they stay stuck in like progressive wokeism, there's no hope for them.
I would see this as one thing I just don't understand at all, actually, and it's something that I think has got worse than got better. Maybe it's just because I moved from Twitter to Telegram. Like, people just can't seem to understand why I do what I do whatsoever, or why I exist in the spaces I exist in. They seem to, you know, at the inverse of the fact that they have a very political identity is then that they see every other person's, you know, supposed identity or whatever term you want to use for it, is an explicitly political thing. And that therefore then you know, in the same way that people bandy about how you can't be a woman in a dissident right, or you can't be gay in a dissident right, or you can't be Jewish in a dissident right, or you can't be trans, or this, that, or the next thing.
Well, and this is the problem with the dissident right. They're so lacking in spirituality. They can only focus on the material. And this is why, I mean, there's many reasons why the dissident right continues to not win, but that's one of the factors, one of many factors. And it's like, you know, if you do take a more spiritual approach to it, you can realize that people are more than just their atoms.
They're more than
their material expression. And I think, you know, Evelyn, you know, you've kind of found your way into the dissident right. And you mentioned to me on Telegram that, you know, you want to be known more for your ideas than anything else, which I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that's a healthy thing. That's a healthy way to approach it, because it's like, well, okay, yeah, you know, this is my sexual expression, but that's not all of who I am. And actually my ideas are far more important than that. Like, I'd like to see more of the LGBT people take that stance, that they have more to offer other than just their sexual expression.
If these people, you know, really were kind of the students of people like Evola that they claim to be, that even if you read what he says here, that these people are a product of a fallen world, you can really only ever treat these people with sympathy. This is not their fault. They are a product of this environment. They are a product of this democratized environment. They're a product of the modern world. And even if you discount what he's saying in the first part of this, we're saying that these people do exist. There are these people who have, you know, this androgynous spirit that leads them to be like this naturally. But as things fall apart, this conflict comes into more and more people, which is a phenomenon I agree with, that there is a small amount of people who genuinely are like this inherently, and there's a large amount of people essentially being sucked into that because they have no center within themselves and can't define themselves, and so who they are becomes a lot more fluid than it should be. Turning these people into pariahs is a bizarre, a very bizarre solution, because it really runs counter to what's being said. It runs counter to the causality, that these people aren't causing the conditions. As we said right at the beginning of this, when we read the quote, they are a product of these conditions. So what you're doing is you're having these people subjected to this fallen world that is causing them to be unable to reconcile their identities. And then what you're doing is you're screaming at these people because they've been affected like that. You're essentially screaming at people because they've been victimized by, you know, by the modern world, as probably Evola would express it. And I don't, you're right, I don't understand. Even if you do take this view that these people are disgusting to you, that they should be pitiable rather than the vitriolic rage that you get, I do not understand it. These people, the only conclusion that I reach is that these people have not read the literature and they do not understand the ideas, because what they are saying really does run counter to both the letter and the spirit of it.
I have a theory on that. I mean, Evola, first of all, was a very spiritual man himself. I don't think anybody can deny that. And it allows him to write with a certain detachment about these things and just state these things very matter-of-factly. But when we're dealing with a large number of people on the dissident right for whom their ideology is the only bulwark against despair and nihilism, it's this higher purpose that they've latched onto, and they essentially treat it as if it's a religion. But many of them are not spiritual at all. They're functionally atheists, even the ones who profess to believe in God. You know, their belief in God isn't really translating into a spiritual chrism within themselves. And so they end up doing the purity spiraling, and they have to have people to react against. And the game continues. It has to continue. They're constantly attached to outcomes from this game that they're playing, because they're not spiritual people. And if they were, like what I found, because I used to be like that myself in my younger days, you know, and in hindsight, I can kind of look back and be like, yeah, you know, I had a lot of hatred and contempt in my heart for people that I considered to be like the enemy. And in many cases for things that, you know, people, they're just born that way or they couldn't help it. Or they're just pitiable creatures of the Kali Yuga. It's not really their fault kind of thing, right? And as I've grown in my own spirituality and been able to have a more detached view of that and not be addicted to the political game, I feel like I can step back and look at it much in the way that Evola does. And so many of the people in the dissident right, even if they have, you know, as you say, read the literature, they're not understanding it or integrating it because they're not spiritual people. Which isn't to say that spirituality suddenly makes you want to tolerate all kinds of degeneracy. It doesn't, but it puts you in a frame of mind that you can see things for what they are and you don't have to necessarily get upset about it. You don't have to have like this strong knee-jerk reaction to it.
I was gonna say, it gives you a much more holistic appreciation for all the different variations of God's creatures, as it were. Shall we read this last super chat and then possibly wrap up, seeing as we're getting close to 10 o'clock here?
Yeah, we can do. Again, apologies for the technical issues. Apologies, Philosocat, for you being muted for the beginning of the stream. We usually do a lot better than this. We've had some really, really bad luck, I think, with all kinds of stuff today. So those of you encountering us for the first time today, this is not our usual flow on stream. And I will be editing this a little bit on the back end to get rid of some of the slightly rougher spots where we've had to repeat ourselves.
If you're talking about the new people that are here, please go through and watch some of our other stuff, because it isn't all just, shall we say, not that there's anything wrong talking about these subjects, but I think we have a wide variety of stuff that I think even people coming over from Cat sort of content, as much more kind of spiritual and whatever else, can still get something out of. And I should also possibly, I think you forward it to your own chat, but I should quickly chuck the link for the Telegram channel we have in the chat as well.
Yes. The last donation there was Glow in the Dark said, low T men is a question of what came first, the feminine men or the low T. I like the theory that it might be just hormonal overload in cities. Your body is a bit of a machine based on external factors. Your body changes. I kind of get what you're going to get there in that, it, you know, what came, it, is it low T because we're selecting for feminine men, or do we have feminine men because there's another factor causing low T? But there doesn't seem to be any real studies on this. Like you said, it seems to be a verboten area of biological study. So it'd be fascinating.
Again,
to see.
It's probably multiple factors. Mm. It's never just one singular cause. It has to stuff like this is usually like a perfect storm of a number of factors all converging together at the right time. So it's like, okay, well, you know, we've got the collapse of the inner form like Evola's talking about, but we've also got an environment where most people are living, you know, oversaturated with phytoestrogens and things like that, and their diets are terrible. They drink way too much beer, stuff like that. So it's going to be like a combination, but I have to say, like, you know, I went through a period of time where I was like just really trying to just balance my hormones naturally. I had a lot of problems, and I found as I did that and I got them all back into the levels they're supposed to be, like, I just like felt so much better, like as a person, not just physically, but like I just mentally felt a lot better as well. And it's like hormones are such sensitive, tricky things, and the slightest change to your hormones can really have a lot of knock-on effects to your whole physiology.
Yeah, just imagine having absolutely none for 20 years.
One of the things I wanted to say about the subject in general is that you asked about like what solutions can we posit from this position, from any position, and the stuff that's being offered up here is relatively powerful. If you can tell somebody that they're feeling the way they are, not because that there is something wrong with them, but because that there's also something wrong with their external environment, and they are feeling degraded and fallen because they live in a degraded and fallen world, and that they are not able to reconcile things because they are not living in an environment that is inducive, and that they need to find ways to center themselves, to feel more spiritually one with themselves. I think that's a very powerful message, and it's one that's been neglected. Mm. If you were able to reach out to, you know, say, members of the trans community and say, look, we think we understand why you're suffering, and these people aren't giving you correct solutions because they can't help you enrich your spirit and they can't help you, you know, be much more at peace with both yourself and the world in a way that people have been for thousands of years. I think it's a huge missed opportunity, and it's something that would be relatively easy to do if people would just quit taking the low hanging fruit. And as we might talk about later, tilting at rainbows, I call it.
Yes.
But that's probably a wider discussion for another time. Is there anything that you want to, I know we've linked your YouTube channel, but is there anything you want to promote or say before we close out here then, Philosophcat?
I guess if you're new to my stuff, go check out my channel, check out the Revolt series. We should have a new episode of that coming out fairly soon after a year-long hiatus. Should have some new music coming out probably at some point as well. You can check out my website, astrologicat.com, which is just astrology stuff. I don't have a website for the Philosophicat stuff. I'm on Telegram, is usually, you know, where you'll find me hanging out. That's pretty much everything I've got.
Okay, I've got your channel up on screen right now. We will be streaming again on Thursday. We will have our regular Thursday stream back. We missed it last week because of the long bank holiday. Again, thank you guys for bearing with us during the technical issues. I will be, like I said, editing this in the back end, so those people on the VOD probably won't have experienced much of this, and they'll be wondering what the hell we're talking about.
It's the rich and unique experience that people get as live viewers.
Yes, it is. It's a wide topic. But
well, we're closing up as well. I will say thank you once again to Kat for coming on. I hope, I suppose there's probably all sorts of future things we can probably think of, discuss, because I quite like the weird interplay of different views of what's going on. It's a lot different from, I think, from the discussions people would typically listen to in our sphere. So maybe yes. there is a niche for the slightly either weirdly spiritual or esoteric or slightly out of left field topics. And I'm glad some people in chat seem to enjoy it as well.
Oh, I like weird. I'm good.
Let's say
we like weird here. It's yeah. When the going gets tough, the tough get weird. Or was it, I don't remember the 100 Stones quote, but thank you guys for what. Yeah. No, it's long, when the going gets weird, the weird go weird. Pro. That's it.
Yeah.
So that might be what's happening here. But thank you guys for watching. Again, thank you to Philosophcat, and thank you to Evelyn for organizing this stream. Again, this is technically Evelyn's show, and we'll hopefully have a few less issues when we see you on Thursday. Oh, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thanks, guys.
Oof, there we go.